Michael Nicholson, Reel 19.
We learnt later, and it's something I put into my commentary, that by releasing these creatures into the river, by giving them freedom, they gained merit and a release from suffering, not necessarily for themselves, but for the people they loved, their own fellow monks, and for the people they would meet in the life hereafter. We filmed it, and both Marvin and I, you know, pretty hard characters by that time, we thought it was rather beautiful. When we reached a line of armoured personnel carriers, about 15 miles on, Nick Long was 50 miles, it must have been less than that, probably about 9, 10 miles. We realised that was the front line. 9, 10 miles from the capital was now where the war was being fought. Now, with the river on our left, between the road and the river were the rice paddies. And it was very quiet. The Cambodian armoured cars were still in a line along the road. There was no firing. It was all very quiet. So we waited with them for about an hour or so. There was no movement. It was obvious the Khmer Rouge were at the other end of the road. We couldn't see them. There was a line of sugar palms, and obviously they were hidden in the among them. So I walked down the road, only 50 yards or so, and there was a little path, a built-up path, because the rice paddies, in order to get across, you know, they'd built up these little banks. So I walked along this bank down toward the river where I could see some women loading a sampan with rice. It was a very pretty little sight. I took a few still photographs, and they, you know, they acted back. They waved to me and smiled to me. I was out of sight. I didn't feel any danger. Casually I walked back along the bank, back to the road, and back to the armoured cars. And as I got back, it could almost have been the signal for the war to begin, because all of a sudden, you know, all hell broke loose. Khmer Rouge opened fire, they started firing mortars, a line of explosions hit the road and kind of came towards us. The engines roared and the armoured personnel carriers reared forward, and the old guns are sweeping across backwards and forwards. And troops ran in between the armour. Little teeny men, you know, buried under bandoliers of ammunition, carrying heavy machine guns. And we moved with them. Amazing. you know, I read my books and I sometimes see some of the film from archive as we put together stories. And I can't believe we did it. I mean, Marvin, as I said, was gung-ho. He had no fear whatsoever. Was never hit once. He's covered the Cambodian War, the Vietnam War, Indo-Pakistan War, not hit once. He still is gung-ho. I've seen him go and lift up a mine when most soldiers would have given it 20 yards clearance. I suppose it was because of that he was gung-ho that I felt gung-ho, maybe because he thought I was gung-ho, he was. Anyway, we ran forward with these soldiers, quite oblivious to the hail of bullets that was coming down the road and the explosions. I suppose also because our soldiers seemed to be so confident, you know, they're very fearless. They were different from the Vietnamese in that respect. They seemed to have no fear. I've actually seen men hit and smile. I never understood why. But then all of a sudden, the guys ahead of us are shot dead. They actually just fell down, bang, 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 bang. And we suddenly realised that it was real stuff, I suppose. You get very dizzy in that kind of confusion. If you're under single fire, you can kind of, once the panic's gone, you can kind of work out, now what do? I stay here? Oh, there's a culvert there. If I can crawl towards that, I'd be much safer there. You can start to think logically. You know, you do actually, being under fire does concentrate your mind enormously. But when it's all happening around you and you don't know, you know, do I run right, do I run left? Well, they're all running in different directions. Who do I follow? So Marvin and I just dive to the ground and we just, you bury your nose and, you know, I've got a long nose, it's hard to bury that. But you think as close you can get to the ground, the safer you're going to be. And of course, that's pretty good advice to give anybody. I felt Marvin's hand, you know, reaching across to drag me undercover, but I felt safe, and I was kind of like a slab of concrete, and I kind of pushed him away, and I said, "No thanks." And Marvin, and his wonderful, wonderful line says, "Do you know, I think some effort is trying to kill me." I couldn't stop laughing the way he said it. Then, blissfully, it rained. This enormous downpour that you get in the afternoons in that part of the world. I mean, rain that comes down so fast, so thick, that you can scarcely keep your eyes open. It hurts so much. You certainly can't see more than 10 yards ahead of you. It is literally a curtain of water, like, you know, facing a waterfall. So we ran, and it was still firing. I mean, they were firing blindly. We were jumping over dead cows, bleeding cows and oxen, and I suddenly saw a hole, which I thought was a dugout, you know, a kind of foxhole, and I went to dive to it, and thank God, Marvin grabbed me by the shirt and pulled me sideways, and it was a well. It was a wide well, and obviously a deep well. I mean, if I'd gone down there, I would never have come up again. So we managed to get into underneath a house, all on stilts there, because of the flooding so close to the river. These shacks are on stilts, and we sat in there beneath, under the floorboards and beneath sacks of corn, waiting for the rain to stop. We knew we were safe while it was raining. We were, you know, dreading it stopping, but it did stop. And I said, right, you know, well, now see, you know, who's won. Knowing that if the Khmer Rouge had won that firefight and the Cambodians had retreated, you know, we were goners. So we were waiting, no use waiting for voices because they all speak the same language. But we heard voices, we heard laughter. That didn't mean anything to us. I suppose we were more terrified then than we had been throughout the whole of that firefight, because we knew that our discovery was either going to mean death or freedom. And then we had an armored car start up. We thought, thank God, because the Khmer Rouge didn't have armored cars. And we walked out into the sunlight, and we saw the old red flag and the golden temple on the red cloth, and we realized that we'd actually survived our last fight of the war. But few of the guys who were out there laughing would survive the peace. We packed our gear, found our car. wasn't a great deal left of it, but it did start. And I don't know why, but I, knowing that we were safe, I walked back along where I'd been, back along that embankment, to the river again. I think I just wanted to be alone for a minute, and that, I remember it had been a rather peaceful, lovely place. But as I walked along that embankment to where the women had been loading the sampans, each side of the embankment was strewn with dead Khmer. And I suddenly realized that they'd all been in their own little foxholes, each side of that embankment, covered in camouflage, covered in palm leaves and whatever. And they would have watched me walk down that embankment only a half an hour, 40 minutes before, and walk back again. I mean, I could have touched them. They could have touched me. And had I seen one of them, of course, I'd have been dead. Quite extraordinary sensation to have been within 20 or 30 of them, because there they were, smashed to smithereens. And had I noticed them, they would have dragged me down and knifed me. I ran back to the car. Yes, he ran back, and I think I was probably in a bit of a shock all the way back to Phnom Penh. And that was my last encounter with the Khmer Rouge. That evening, back in the hotel, Monorom Hotel, I tuned into BBC World Service. I always did, we all did. The wonderful BBC World Service News and Lily Bolero, one of my favourite tunes. Can't imagine the effect it has on you when you listen to it when you're a long way away and when you've been through something like that, the voice of home. And they were reporting that the northern provinces of Vietnam were falling fast. In fact, the provincial government had abandoned the northern provinces, which meant the war was now virtually over. Everyone was racing south for the last stand. But as far as we all knew that was we had witnessed the end of Cambodia. We were now beginning to witness the end of Vietnam. And I got a cable from my office saying that they were sending Sandy Gore to Vietnam. And I thought, no way. I'm not staying here to be butchered by the Khmer Rouge. And I sent an immediate cable back to them. I think it went something along the lines that consider me already in Saigon and send your suicide man here. And that evening, I packed my bags. Marvin had his own ideas of getting out. I think he wanted to get out to Hong Kong, and there were flights to Hong Kong. I said, no, I'm going to Saigon. I'm going to see my war out there. And I hitched a lift with an American relief plane. I had actually tried to get on the British Embassy plane. They'd got a DC-3 that I think was flying to Bangkok. They'd evacuated the British Embassy. And to this day, I've never understood why, but the plane was packed with crates, and they couldn't all have been, embassy files. Because I assumed I'd get a lift with them. Because they were flying into Saigon, obviously to get out to Bangkok. And I joked, you've got all the treasures of Angkor Wat stowed in there, haven't you? And of course, that really upset them, and they slammed the door, and I didn't get my flight. Anyway, I did get my relief flight out with the Americans and landed in Saigon that evening, where I stayed for the rest of the war. When I flew out with an old buddy. In fact, it's the guy that I dedicated my book, A Measure of Danger, to, Neil Davis. He was a Tasmanian, Australian cameraman, combat cameraman, the finest. And we flew out together. And as we flew out of Phnom Penh, we looked down, very yellow light, dusk light, odd light. And there are lots of little islands in the Mekong. And on each island, I mean tiny islands, some of them only a couple of hundred yards across, were little fires burning and the red flag. The Khmer Rouge flag. They were flying their flags, waiting for the order to cross and declare the war over and Cambodia there. We were not to know what was to come, but they were waiting to begin what turned out to be the greatest slaughter since the Holocaust and the entry of Pol Pot into our vocabulary. When he began his macabre social experiment, he would empty the cities, he would ban money and marriage and cars and churches and medicines and education, even family. He was to ban even the family. And I told you that Chung Ek, that wonderful little park where the genteel middle classes went with their children to enjoy the Sunday afternoon teas in Offenbach. He turned that into his killing fields. And if you wanted to be even more, if you wanted to be the ultimate in cruelty and cynicism, he turned the genteel girls' high school, it was called Tulsleng, a high school in Phnom Penh, where the girls were beautifully dressed in their uniforms and well-behaved and played lacrosse and all the rest of it. He turned that into his torture chambers. He was about to turn the future into the past tense, and he called it Year Zero. And I remember a little Vietnamese poem that was written, and the translation was this. Let me read it to you. In Cambodia, the unburied dead cry for vengeance, and the living dead cry for pity, and both cry in vain. And that was my last evening in Phnom Penh. And I, as I said, I flew out with Neil, and as we watched those flickering fires, so my last memory of Phnom Penh and wartime Cambodia is flying out in that American rice plane over the river, and as I watched those flickering fires and those fluttering red flags, Neil Davis, who had done more in his filming to show people what was happening in Cambodia, and his words too, he wrote some beautiful words. He loved Cambodia. He married a Cambodian girl. And we looked at each other, and he was crying. There were tears in his eyes. And he said to me, "Nick, the shits have won again." I think memorable words, because you can relate those words to so many wars before and since, can't you? Nick, the shits have won again. And that was the end of the war in Cambodia for me. I didn't go back to Asia, Vietnam or Cambodia, for another, 9 years. That was because I was posted as bureau chief for ITN in South Africa. So from 75, 76 onwards until 81, I was Africa was my patch. And then when I came back from Africa, I became a newscaster. So I was out of the plot, as it were, out of the scene. But then it was decided I should go back for the 10-year anniversary of the ending of the wars. And that was 1985. I went to Vietnam first, went to Hanoi for the first time, and then traveled all the way down Vietnam, along its spine, as it were, into Saigon to see post-war Saigon. It was fascinating to go into Hanoi, because one had learned so much from the Americans about how it had been destroyed, you know, how their carpet bombing had reduced the city. In fact, there was hardly any evidence at all of their bombing, other than coming into land and you suddenly saw these pock marks all over the fields. But because so much of Hanoi was built in a kind of ramshackle way, what was destroyed was quickly rebuilt. So when I went back in 85, 10 years after the end of their war in Vietnam, there was virtually no evidence of war, except the poverty that existed there and still exists. You know, the Americans were very vindictive about their defeat. They refused to trade with Vietnam. They refused any aid to Vietnam. And they tried to forbid other nations, including Britain, to trade with Vietnam. In fact, we learned that they were not quite as vindictive as that, because they were actually searching for oil off Vietnam, but using other countries to do the searching for them. We went on a number of American operations searching for missing MIAs, missing in action, because the Americans were convinced, at least a certain lobby in America was convinced that there were still American prisoners of war being held, you know, in cages or being in forced labor camps, none of which was true. But they did spend an awful lot of money searching for remnants of, you know, this pilot or that soldier whenever a bone was discovered. There was quite a business in Vietnam, you know. They would find a human bone and bury it somewhere where they knew there'd been an air crash, and suddenly tell the Americans, "We have found the bone of an American." So then all the American American operation got underway for digging up, or there'd be a metal tag found. It was quite good business for the Vietnamese. I mean, they made quite a bit of money out of it, quite rightly so. We went down through the DMZ, which was still active, of course. I mean, it was covered in mines. People were still losing their legs. There was quite a big business too. In concrete, can you imagine? All the runways, all the American buildings were demolished, and the concrete crushed to be used again. It was a way, and of course all the metal that was left behind, all the tanks and that were left behind, were all salvaged and sold off to the Chinese or the Koreans for metal. There was quite a bonanza when the war ended for the Vietnamese to salvage what was left behind. Of course, the Americans left in such a hurry; they left a hell of a lot behind. I told you I met a Vietnamese ex-army man in a rehabilitation center. It was more like a morgue. All these poor men who had served their country were blinded or paralyzed and were put into these centers. I met this man, and he was sitting at a machine, and if I've told you this story, you must stop me. He was blind, and all he did, he sat at this machine, he pulled a handle, shoved, pulled a handle, there, like this, all day. He did this 8 hours a day, and he was making nails. We interviewed him, because he was something of a celebrity. I think I told you there was a film, The Full Metal Jacket. Have I told you this story? there he was making nails 8 hours a day, and he was a celebrity, we discovered, because there was a movie made by Kubrick, I think. It was called Full Metal Jacket. It was all about the Vietnam War, and in it, it shows the Battle of Hue and a Marine going through a hole in the wall and being shot by a sniper, and another Marine going through the same hole to retrieve the body, and he too is shot. And this happens seven times. Seven Marines are shot, or six Marines die in order to retrieve the body of the first. And this was the sniper. This was the man who had killed those men. In the movie, it's an attractive, beautiful girl. He was just a thin, wiry little Vietnamese sniper. And he said to me, could not understand, he said. I killed the first American, then I killed the second, and I killed the third. I thought, this is amazing. These men are very stupid. They are very brave. And I said, did you regret killing them? He said, no, that was my job. But they were brave men, and they were young men, and I was very sad. And he was blinded a week later by a grenade. We came across fields where veterans were working. We came across one field, a one-legged plowman. He had a wooden leg. And he was plowing with a wooden plow shear, behind an oxen. And I made the point in my commentary that here was Vietnam boasting the fourth, fifth largest army in the world, and yet they were still farming the way they had been farming for 1,000, 2,000 years. the fourth, fifth biggest army in the world. And there we were filming women planting rice singly, each plant. Thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of women in hundreds of thousands of acres of paddy fields planting rice by hand. And yet the country boasting the fourth largest army in the world. It was a tale of two countries. And it occurred to me that nothing would ever change until the old guard moved on. Because once you go south, you move into another country. I always said Vietnam, even though it's united now, is still two countries. The austere, Comintern, communist north, and the happy-go-lucky, Americanized, westernized south. And coming into Saigon, it was so different from Hanoi. We did a lovely little story. We did a story on, I forget the Vietnamese word for it, but it's the children the Vietnamese left behind. I think the Vietnamese word for them translated means the dust of the road. That means the dirt that's left behind by the GIs. And again, I may have told you this story, but it was fascinating that the Americans were convinced that there were still Americans in Vietnam in forced labor camps because certain aid workers, mostly Scandinavians, had seen black workers in the fields. I said the old word was Negro, but it's the American African in the fields. Now, when we did this story about the dust of the road, the half-caste children, we came across African-Americans. Now, they'd had black fathers and Vietnamese mothers, but the black gene was so strong, it had obliterated the Vietnamese. All you were looking at among in those black children were American blacks. So I could understand Scandinavians, anybody, seeing these adolescents, these teenagers working in the fields, and grown men now, of course, we thought, what? They're Americans, black Americans. Part of that story was seeing the children, these children, being sent off home, to their new home, that is. Vietnamese mothers who couldn't cope with them, didn't want to cope with them, were having them adopted by American families. Now, some of them, these American families, wherever they were in America, probably had lost sons in Vietnam. Or they may have known that their sons had married Vietnamese wives before they were killed. And so perhaps he felt some sense of guilt, some sense of some obligation to adopt a Vietnamese child of mixed marriage. And so you had these very, very sad scenes of children being sent off to strange families in a strange country, and they'd never see their child again. Some of them, little Madam Butterflies, I think was the word I used, because they were so pretty in their eyes, little kids of, 13, 14, all going off not to see Vietnam again. And I think I've covered most of this, haven't I? And I've told you about David and Nyep. As a consequence of doing that story when I was back in England, somebody contacted me. He was a tour operator who did tours to Vietnam. And he said he was taking out a father, a Vietnamese father, who lived in Colwyn Bay in North Wales, who was a watchmaker. And he was going back to collect his son, who he'd left behind 10 years before when he'd been a boat person. I met Nyep and his wife in Colwyn Bay, and it seems that in 1975, Nyep had escaped as a boat person with his wife and a baby. Now, he had two children. One was 3 years old, and one was only 6 months. Now, the mother of Nyep, the children's grandmother, said, "You will not take both children because you will certainly die. All the boat people die. They never get to Hong Kong. I want a child here, a male child, to remain to continue the family." And so he agreed. And they left their eldest son behind. let's say 3 years old. Nieppe, once he'd come to England and established himself here, applied year after year after year to the Vietnamese for him to come back and collect his son, and they said no.